This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Idstey in Washington, filling in for Neil Conan. The testimony of General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker has dominated the news this week. Their report card on Iraq, when it's done, will have taken 2 days and spawned countless hours of analysis from experts at Washington think tanks, partisan bloggers, and customers at the local coffee shop. The long-awaited report was, for the most part, calm and measured. It pointed to some successes in the notorious Anbar province, for instance, but was realistic about political challenges remaining. Today is a day for analysis, and processing the report is different depending on your point of view. But we'd like your take today. If you were on Capitol Hill, what would you have wanted to ask Ryan Crocker and General Petraeus? After hearing from them, what's your view now? Should the U.S. stay the course or change course in Iraq? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the hour, it's the sixth anniversary of 9/11, when almost 3,000 Americans were killed in the worst terror attack on American soil. How are you marking this day, if you're marking it at all? But first, a moment of truth for progress on the Iraq War. But first, a moment of truth for progress on the Iraq War, or just more spin. Joining me now is NPR's Ann Garrell. She's in Adamiya, a Sunni enclave in mostly Shiite East Baghdad. Annie, welcome to the program.
Nice to talk to you.
Earlier today, General Petraeus said in his testimony to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that Baghdad is one Sunni area where people have turned against al-Qaeda. Is that what you're seeing there?
Well, that Adamiya is one area, yes. Adamiya is a Sunni enclave, as you noted, in eastern Baghdad, which is now predominantly Shiite. It's where Sadr, the huge, poor Shiite slum of Sadr City is, and Adamiya is not far from it. It was the last place that Saddam Hussein appeared as U.S. troops came into Baghdad. At the Abu Hanifa Mosque. It has been a stronghold for al-Qaeda, and it has also been a stronghold for people who, for Sunnis who simply rejected the American occupation, as they felt it was. But gradually, al-Qaeda, as they had done in Anbar, province began to kill too many Sunnis here. They began to impose their own particular fundamentalist views, and people rejected them. A month ago, al-Qaeda killed the son of a very respected person here in Adamiya, and that family and their supporters, and even those who object to the Americans being here, stormed the Abu Hanifa Mosque along with the Iraqi army, who they don't normally support, in order to throw out al-Qaeda. So that was a major landmark. And people here are beginning to work more closely with the Americans, providing tips, and the Americans are here in large numbers.
So General Petraeus is suggesting that this change in Adamiya is a result of U.S. policy and the surge. Is it as a consequence of U.S. policy, or is it just coincidental?
No, I think it's both. I think it was a natural evolution. Sorry, the line is a bit iffy, but
we can still
we'll
hear you
going.
Fine. Go ahead.
Great. I mean, people just got fed up with the violence. They got fed up with al-Qaeda, and they also got fed up with being attacked by Shiite militias. And the U.S., by more than doubling their presence here, provided security so those who were against al-Qaeda felt they had some more protection. The U.S. would go after them if they called. So it was a double whammy. Before, you know, there were very few troops here. They really couldn't patrol the streets on a regular basis. They couldn't put a lid on al-Qaeda, no matter how much they tried.
Let's get to what Ambassador Crocker had to say. He was, optimistically pessimistic about, or pessimistically optimistic about the government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Here he is testifying at the Senate today. We're supposed to have some tape of Mr. al-Maliki. Let me ask you, Anne, while we get that tape, do you get a sense that Iraqis are paying attention to this report?
Not too much, no, frankly. People are pretty exhausted. They've heard so much, you know, they want to know, is the U.S. going to stay or going to leave? The intricacies of the debate, are not being followed word for word.
Let's try to get that Ambassador Crocker tape once again. Ambassador Crocker, as we said, was sort of pessimistically optimistic about the government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, and here he is testifying in the Senate today.
The government, in many respects, is dysfunctional, and members of the government know it. There is a lot of discontent about that in and out of government. And if you will, that's some qualified good news. People who previously espoused a strict sectarian or ethnic line in how positions were apportioned, for example, are now saying this isn't working. That's part of the debate in Iraq, and a fairly common part of the debate. The application is going to be a lot more difficult, but Iraqis are talking about precisely that kind of dysfunctionality.
So Iraqis are recognizing the dysfunctionality of their government, according to Ambassador Crocker.
The
way you see it?
People are fed up.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. I mean, people are totally fed up.
Is that a hopeful sign, do you think?
Well, I think Ambassador Crocker is right in that people at the community level are in some places beginning to work together. It's still very tentative, it's still fragile. But people are looking to, first of all, for instance, in Adamiya, they're working with the Iraqi army, which was considered initially as sort of a Shiite institution. They won't work still with the national police, which they consider completely sectarian and a tool of Shiite extremists in many cases. But they are beginning, and they're beginning to ask, okay, what really is the future of Iraq? What does it mean to be Iraqi? How do we move on? I mean, we've seen that in Anbar. We're seeing that in Amariya, another Sunni enclave. We're seeing that in Adamiya, in mixed neighborhoods north of here where I've been in the last few days, some of the last mixed, really mixed communities, quietly sheikhs from Sunni and Shiite tribes are talking together and trying to, in the first few steps, trying to sort of plot a future.
Is it your sense, though, that the political clock in Baghdad is going to move fast enough for the political clock in Washington?
Well, that's the great question, and that, of course, is what Petraeus and Crocker were up against yesterday and today on the Hill. They didn't put it quite this way, but I mean, we really haven't done a very good job over the last 4 years. And in the last year, people sort of finally got it, is certainly the way Petraeus and Crocker feel. There is progress now. I mean, it's taken a lot more troops, a lot more pressure on the government. And as both of them said, it's horribly frustrating. It's going to take a long time. And they both urge patience. Whether people will go along with that and believe that there is progress, you know, is the great question. But as both of them said, the alternative of not trying while you've got this moment of opportunity is the alternative is probably worse, mm-hmm. in their view.
Thank you, Annie.
You're welcome.
NPR Baghdad correspondent Anne Garrels, she joined us from Adamiya. Gordon Lubald is in Iraq as well. He's the Pentagon correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and he's on the phone with us from Baghdad. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Mr. Lubolt, how long have you been in Iraq?
I've been in Iraq about about 2 weeks now.
2 weeks now?
About a week in Baghdad and then a week in Anbar province.
And you've been with some Marines there, I understand.
That's correct. Yeah, I spent about a week in Fallujah, going out with some units and talking to some of the officers there about what they're doing.
And have they been paying any attention to what General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker are saying here in Washington?
You know, I think it's an interesting question because I think I don't know about Washington, but. It may or may not have been the watershed moment there, and it certainly didn't seem like it was here. I think the rank and file are going about their jobs and kind of know how long their deployment is going to last. And the testimony, while very interesting to folks at home, is kind of just another wrinkle to them in a debate that's lasted 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any sense of whether Iraqis are following Petraeus's report to Congress?
Yeah, I think they are in kind of a secondary way. They're obviously very interested in what's going on here. The Iraqis I've spoken with the last several days indicate, there was this obviously turnaround that everybody's been talking about in Anbar. Where they went from one state of mind about the American presence to a completely other one. I talked to a Sunni sheikh a few days ago, who is a huge supporter of the American forces, in this case the Marines there in Fallujah. But he also recognizes that most of his people do not want an occupation, as he puts it, to last much longer. He thinks that there's need a little bit more time to kind of sort some of the political things out at the regional and the city level.
Gordon Lubolt, could you stay with us, please, over our break? We're talking about the report of General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker, and I'm John Idsty. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Idsty in Washington, and we're talking about Iraq this hour. After 2 days of testimony from Ambassador Crocker and General Petraeus, what's the prognosis for the war in Iraq? And we'd like to hear from you this hour. After hearing about the testimony, what's your view? Should the U.S. stay the course or change it in Iraq? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And check out our blog at npr.org/blog of the nation. And with us still on the line is Gordon Lubolt, Pentagon correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, who's in Baghdad and has spent the last couple of weeks with Marines and talking to Iraqis. Mr. Lubolt, have you been able to follow what the general and the ambassador have said, and do you think they're giving us an accurate picture of the current situation in Iraq?
I did follow what they said, and from my corner of the sandbox, as military folks like to say, it seems like it makes sense. I think that it's not an irrational exuberance that these American officials are having about the situation in Anbar, because you talk to people here, Marines, local Iraqis, and they really can point to some tangible success there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed, General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker have made much of that progress in Anbar province, and I think we've got some tape of General Petraeus talking about that today. Let's hear that right now.
The most significant development in the past 6 months likely has been the increasing emergence of tribes and local citizens rejecting al-Qaeda and other extremists. The success in Anbar is an example of what can happen when local Iraqis decide to oppose al-Qaeda and reject its Taliban-like ideology and indiscriminate violence.
That was General Petraeus. Gordon Lubolt, are there indications that the successes in Anbar can be repeated elsewhere in Iraq?
Well, that naturally is the big question. I think what my big takeaway from spending time with Marines out there is that the situation, and I know your listeners probably get tired of hearing this, but it is complex. General Petraeus said that, and I think that this thing they refer to as the on-bar model really doesn't can't be just projected onto another spot. But what can be done, I think, is, and what some of these folks are trying to do in other areas is the thrust of it is listening to the locals, talking to them, engaging them in a way, and then responding accordingly instead of doing it kind of the American way and projecting it that way. I think where the success occurred in Anbar was the result of Marines listening and then responding. So if they can do that in Shia strongholds, and then maybe it can be replicated. But it's very specific to each area.
Mm-hmm. Gordon Lubald, if you'd just stay on the line for us while we take a call, I'd appreciate it. We're going to go to Frank in Shepherdstown, Kentucky. Hello, Frank. You're on the air.
Yes.
Do you have a comment or question?
Go ahead, sir.
Do you have a comment or question?
Yes. I would ask the general why the Iraqi army is taking as long as it does to be ready to take over the job when we send our young men and women over there after 6 months of training, and they're quite competent to do their job.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. We don't have General Petraeus here, but let's ask Gordon Lubald if he has some ideas about that.
I wouldn't pretend to try to be able to answer on the same par, but the focus here really is obviously standing up the Iraqi army, but the Iraqi police is kind of where the if you forgive me the cliche, the rubber meets the road, because it's the police force that can respond locally, and it's the police force which is indigenous to those areas. So in a Sunni area, you can get Sunni police who can listen and work out in the neighborhoods and likewise in Shia areas. And also should be noted that the Sunni-Shia split that we hear so much about is not always as important as the tribal politics beneath it. But the army is doing well, as well as it can be expected, perhaps. The folks I talked to point out that, in many ways, they are starting from scratch, and they've been able to do some stuff, even though they're not as successful in other areas.
Well, thanks very much, Gordon Lubald.
Thank you.
Gordon Lubald is the Pentagon correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with us from Baghdad. We've just heard what it's like in Iraq on the ground, but what about the mood in Washington? P.J. Crowley is a senior fellow and director of Homeland Security at the Center for American Progress. He joins us here in our Studio 3A. Welcome to the program.
Pleasure, John.
So what are your impressions of the hearings yesterday and today?
Well, I think there are insights here. I don't think they necessarily change either, the broad knowledge about the situation in Iraq. I don't think they'll really seriously change the established and pretty firm, political positions on various different levels and across institutions, the Congress versus the administration, across partisan lines, Democrats versus Republicans. But obviously, it's very important testimony.
Mm-hmm. What do you think needs to be done in Iraq in order for the U.S. to move forward?
Well, I think there's a little bit of a disconnect between the surge on the one hand, which has received most of the political scrutiny, and the long-term strategy for Iraq on the other, which is probably more of what Ambassador Crocker was talking about. And I think we have to make sure that obviously, what General Petraeus says is important because he's the commander, he has the troops on the ground, and they are in harm's way on a daily basis. But I think what Ambassador Crocker was talking about relates to the long-term commitment that the United States has to Iraq and the U.S. interest instability in Iraq. And I think Ambassador Crocker was saying, on the one hand, I think one phrase he used, that there is a ethno-sectarian competition for power and resources going on in Iraq. And the real question that we may not be able to answer at this point is whether that competition will be resolved through peaceful means or violent means. General Petraeus is talking about the success of the surge as a tactic, but General Petraeus himself has said many times that there is no there was no military solution in Iraq. So in part, this may be the beginning of where finally Washington gets past the politics of the surge and begins to focus on the long term, because the net effect of the testimony over 2 days is that there will be at least 100,000 troops in Iraq when the next president is inaugurated 16 months from now. This means that Iraq will be the dominating issue in the 2008 presidential campaign.
As Ambassador Crocker suggested, the government in Iraq is dysfunctional because of this ethnic competition, and Iraqis are beginning to see this dysfunctionality even at the leadership level and want a change, and he sees that as a hopeful sign. Do you see this dysfunctionality, or recognizing this dysfunctionality, as a hopeful sign, or is it just recognizing what's there and what we have to live with?
Well, I think I was teasing someone earlier. If you evaluated the United States government and the United States Congress on a series of benchmarks, our politicians would not necessarily do all that much better either. You know,
but they're not faced with rampant violence and chaos in their country.
They are
either.
Not,
and
they might
react differently.
I think the point you made earlier is the real salient point, that there is an Iraqi timetable, and there is a Washington timetable. I think Ambassador Crocker's appeal for more time is an effort to kind of try to in some way reconcile those two. But I mean, either way, one way or the other, we are going to have a long-term commitment to Iraq that goes over years, if not decades. The real question is, what is the military component of that long-term commitment? And that is something that's still being wrestled with here in Washington.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to a caller, Bob in Detroit, Michigan. Bob, you have a question or comment?
Yes. I hadn't heard much discussion of infrastructure, general economy, and unemployment, which presumably also have to be solved for stability in the country. I don't know if I just missed it or they didn't just cover that.
Well, I missed it if they talked about it as well. P.J. Crowley, did you hear anything about those issues?
Well, by inference, I think Ambassador Crocker over the course of 2 days has stressed on a couple of occasions that in order to have political progress and in order to have reconciliation, you have to have the preconditions that allows that to emerge. And certainly it's very difficult when you have various elements that are blowing up infrastructure, that are inhibiting the export of oil or the production of electricity or what have you. It is very difficult to see how you get meaningful economic progress in the absence of at least a baseline of security. Certainly, the caller is exactly right that the corner will be turned only when people see greater gain to be made through peaceful economic means than through violent means. That's how we've seen a resolution of various other crises around the world, certainly in Northern Ireland, for example, only when they thought that they could prosper, through a peaceful situation, did you really see that corner kind of turn.
Given that you say the political situation is key, what did you think about General Petraeus's withdrawal plan? He's talking about taking 35,000 troops out by next summer.
Well, certainly, as a person who spent 26 years in the Air Force, from a military standpoint, that makes that there's a logic to what he's saying. The real question is what he's saying is that we'll get back down to pre-surge levels by next summer. And now you have to kind of, take that military imperative and compare it to other strategic imperatives or, political imperatives. I mean, to an extent, this was meaningful testimony. But, the senators today, for example, were asking, the big questions. I think Senator Menendez said, how long will troops be there? Senator Obama said, how does this relate to, or is this worth the investment? I think Senator Feingold said, how does this relate to our broader strategy against al-Qaeda? These are very big and significant questions, but Ambassador Crocker and General Petraeus are the executors of policy vis-a-vis Iraq. They are not the instigators of the broader strategy. That belongs to Condi Rice, Robert Gates, the president himself. And so, in a sense, the big questions are there on the table, but that will be something that the president will have to fill in light of this testimony.
Mm-hmm. Let's bring another voice into the discussion. Michael O'Hanlon has been in Iraq recently, and he's been monitoring these hearings closely. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute and joins us from Capitol Hill. Welcome to the program.
Hi, nice to be with you.
So what's your view of what you've heard so far? Is it hopeful? Are you pessimistic?
I guess I'd start with two observations. One, I think this was a very good series of hearings to have, and I think it's just getting a lot of information on the table, and hopefully, to my mind at least, invalidating some of the more extreme charges that are out there. For example, that somehow Petraeus is not credible. I think we're seeing evidence that he's telling it like it is, and it's not all good news, clearly. So I think just getting that base of information on the table is important, but also for war supporters to realize just how bad the security environment is. And as Senator Obama pointed out, it's no great accomplishment to get things back to the levels of violence of early 06. So I feel like there's been an effort to, you know, to some extent challenge some of the more extreme rhetoric among partisans on both sides of this, and that's healthy. But I also feel that that's my first point. Second point, though, this is a little bit of an anticlimactic week in one sense, because a lot of this information had been gradually seeping out. And moreover, the Congress had already essentially said it wasn't going to use this September to cut off funding for the war. Now, there may still be a rider here or there in an appropriations bill that necessitates a small change in policy, but I doubt it will amount to very much. And once the Congress sort of unilaterally disarms itself in that regard, and I'm not blaming the Congress, but that's essentially what it did, the ability for Congress to change policy based on law is almost vanished, because you're not going to get a two-thirds veto-proof majority on any other bill, and Mr. Bush can veto anything else except the appropriation, which, of course, he needs to keep prosecuting the war. So in that sense, it's maybe a week that's been built up too much compared to the policy importance of what we were going to hear. I think it's more important for the longer-term debate over Iraq policy, and especially as that will affect the presidential campaign next year.
Stay with us, Michael. We're going to go to a caller, but we want to say that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Andrew, in Louisville, Kentucky, you have a question or a comment?
Yes. Thanks for taking my call. The comment I have is it seems to me that all of the progress that we've seen has all been sort of in a mono-ethnic context, if you will, first initially with the Kurds, of course, now with the Sunnis in Anbar, and it seems where we're seeing progress, it's in areas where there is ethnic separation, and I haven't heard anything this week that suggests to me that at some point when we leave that the country isn't going to fracture along sectarian lines anyway. And would it not make more sense at this point just to simply try to have that occur in as orderly a fashion as possible, have it happen now if it's inevitable, and then get out as quickly as we can? And I'll take your response offline. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Let's ask Michael O'Hanlon first, if he's still with us.
Yes, I think that's a tremendously good question, and maybe because I share some of the thoughts behind it, I've advocated soft partition. But the problem is you need to get the Iraqis aboard to make that kind of a plan work. Then you have to build up two new regional governments that currently do not exist. There's only the one up in Kurdistan, of course, right now. You would need to reorganize the Iraqi security forces to be largely along regional lines. And then for the logic of this idea to really take effect, you would have to convince Iraqis, at least on a voluntary basis, for many of them to relocate their homes and their families to places they were no longer in the minority. So it's a daunting proposition. Some people have said, why not try to, if no one's going to agree to this in a formal way where you create all these new institutions, could you at least sort of let it happen on the ground? Can you stop trying to cork up the ethnic cleansing and sort of let it play out with as little loss of life as possible? And I'm sympathetic to that sentiment. I just don't quite know how to make it happen in real life. I think that, unfortunately, when you do get the population relocations by violence, a lot of killing goes along with that. So it's the part of the problem I'm most interested in myself. Operationally, how do you try to encourage people to move, even if you have no formal plan for soft partition? And I think that may become the big political challenge of the next few months, especially if there's no big breakthroughs in Baghdad from al-Maliki and others in the next few months, and I expect there won't be. So I'm with the caller.
P.J. Crowley, how about you? What about walking away and letting Iraq partition itself?
Well, I think Iraq is going to largely partition itself. Part of the subtext of the testimony today was the fact that there has been kind of a de facto, ethnic cleansing, if you wish, where through violence and through other means, Iraq is sorting itself into three largely contiguous and monoethnic areas. But there are still some flashpoints that have to be resolved, and that can only be resolved politically.
Stay with us, Michael O'Hanlon and P.J. Crowley. We'll talk about this some more. But coming up, Abu Ghraib has become synonymous with torture and abuse. For one woman, though, who was a nurse at the prison, it forced her to humanize the enemy. I'm John Idsty. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. With us in the studio is P.J. Crowley, a senior fellow and director of Homeland Security at the Center for American Progress. And on the line, we hope still, is Michael O'Hanlon, senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. And I want to ask both of you, what political difference is this going to make, this testimony going to make here in Washington? Michael O'Hanlon, you've already suggested that the Democrats don't have the votes. Are they going to change their political tactics in any way?
Well, I don't know. I look forward to PJ's comments, but I would tend to say that in many ways the importance of this is for the presidential race, not for the congressional deliberations of the next few weeks. And, you know, it's very important whether Clinton or Obama or Edwards or whoever else might get the nomination. It's going to be very important, the detail in their plans. They've all conveyed, especially the first two, Clinton and Obama, the most likely nominees, that they see Iraq as a complex theater. And their plans will have complexity in them, and they will have to evolve over the next 16 months because the situation will evolve. And so I think, in a way, the most important thing is how these sets of hearings begin to affect the thinking and the conversations that will occur over the next few months as the eventual nominees for both parties develop their Iraq policy plans as they get ready to face the electorate and run for president in November 08.
Your views, P.J. Crowley.
I think there are two sets of divides here. There is an institutional divide, the executive branch versus the legislative branch. And so there is built-in tension. And from just a legislative standpoint, it's very, very difficult at a time of war and peace for a legislative branch to overturn, you know, the prerogative of the executive as the commander-in-chief. I mean, even in going back to Vietnam, it eventually, you know, it was the Congress that pulled the plug in 1975, but it took a decade before it was able to do that. So it's not surprising that that while there will be, you know, greater oversight and perhaps a more shrill political debate coming out of this, ultimately I think the Congress will, you know, defer to the president either by design or just by the failure to get to 60 votes in the Senate. I think exactly right that Michael is that this will ensure that there are substantial troops in Iraq as we go to the polls a year from November. And so this will be the dominating issue. You know, and it will be, I think, the longer the president holds on to the surge, and holding on to the surge does go contrary to at least a majority view of the American people. That would certainly, you know, perhaps color the debate in some respects and give the Democrats a little bit of an advantage going into the 2008 presidential election. But clearly, Iraq will continue to be the dominating factor, and obviously, you know, the next president will have to detail as the campaign goes along what he or she will do to resolve the situation in Iraq when inaugurated in January 2009.
General Petraeus did mention al-Qaeda in Iraq in his testimony, and probably on this sixth anniversary of 9/11, it's appropriate that we talk about that as our last question. How much of a threat do you think the group poses in Iraq, P.J. Crowley?
Well, I don't think that Iraq in itself, the military resolution of the situation in Iraq, necessarily has as significant an impact on U.S. security here in the homeland as al-Qaeda Central in Pakistan does. You know, because the al-Qaeda in Iraq is primarily focused on creating an al-Qaeda, you know, stronghold there in the country. It is primarily Iraqi in nature, although it does have some foreign influence. Nonetheless, I think we have to be cautious that just as we left the Mujahideen standing in Afghanistan in the early 90s and it kind of morphed into al-Qaeda that became a threat to the United States, we have to be mindful of just what happens to that residual capability, whatever happens in Iraq. And I'm more worried about the broader movement across the Middle East with, like, al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, for example, than I am about al-Qaeda in Iraq, per se.
P.J. Crowley, Senior Fellow and Director of Homeland Security at the Center for American Progress, thank you very much. And Michael Ohanian, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, we appreciate your comments today as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.